Yeah, yeah. Well, it's James. He came over to be. So I was basically there. It is ceremony to make him a bishop, right? So he became a he had been studying for years correspondence with, because Bertio, he would advertise in the back of Fate magazine and stuff. You know, all these different ads and stuff, and you'd write in for all these different occult schools, and they were all him. That was actually how I met my late wife. Is he was yeah, because Michael was basically he was gay. He was very creative, sort of. I didn't mind, you know, but that wasn't sort of my trip as far as his whole sex magic thing. But then he said, oh, because I got this one woman writing me from New Zealand. He goes, I can't, because energy is too female for me. He says, why don't you write her? So he actually handed over to me. And we started corresponding, and that was how I met her. And she was a fascinating, brilliant woman that we worked with for, we were together for like 20 years and stuff. But but she had actually done the 4 years of the Monastery of Seven Rays and passed through all the grades and had gone through the traditional sort of thing with that. So, all in all, it was a very fascinating field. But then when I took over Borderlands, like I went out to California. And also, Bertio turned me on to radionics. He had an old Albert Abrams machine that he had turned into some sort of like voodoo-tronic sort of transmitter that was connected up with wires to his altar. I mean, the guy was absolutely fascinating. Brilliant artist. I've got an original Bertio painting here he did of my guardian angel and stuff for me. But when I got into the borderland sciences and started looking into Goethe's theory of color, it transformed my consciousness. And I... because at the same time I was doing that, I was also studying the Vajrayana, you know, the mandala teachings. And I didn't even know why at the time, because I still couldn't figure out what in hell it was. But I just sort of dropped all that occultism. I sold my Crowley books and stuff. I mean, I had like, you know, the Paris Folios, as they call them, you know, which was the magic and theory and practice from the, you know, published in the four. I actually had two sets of them. Got like $1,200 for one of them. I can't remember for the other. And I only kept the Grant books just because of my correspondence with him. So that was actually quite sort of fascinating stuff. But yeah, I remember writing to Grant and talking to him about, you know, Goethe's theory of color and the mandala and how I was starting to see things different and all that. And he's going, well, you know, it's all relative anyway. You know, almost the same sort of thing you get from like quantum physicists today. And when I found out, as fascinated as he was, Grant was very dogmatic. I'm not so sure he experienced all the things he spoke of. He was a fascinating writer. And one of the things that sort of, I mean, because I was always very open and I knew all sorts of people from, I mean, I'd go to Shinto temples and I'd go to occult bookstores and I'd even go to cathedrals and things like that just to check them out. I was open to everything. But I believe it was in Aleister Crowley in The Hidden God, in that book, there's one little tiny line where he admits that he's working for, he calls it the,
the seven tongue, I forget.
No, yeah, something about Satan. Yeah, the realm of Satan. Mm. And I'm thinking, well, you know, because I always thought, you know, guys like Anton LaVey and stuff, I always thought they were a bit wacky. You know, I didn't really go along with that satanic sort of approach to stuff. And Bertio had a book on the history of Satan, this old book, because, you know, he was like an Anglican prelate. Bertio was he was up in Seattle and he worked for the Anglican Church. I can't remember what a prelate is, but I think remember him telling me that's what he was. And he went down to he got stationed in Port-au-Prince, and his sponsor was the Jean Main family, the head of which at the time the patriarch was Hector Francois Jean Main, who was Papa Doc's spiritual advisor and head of the Tonton Macoutes. So that's where Bertio got his voodoo connection from in that sense. But anyway, Bertio had his fascinating library. I loved going through his books, but he had this book on the history of Satan. And the first chapter was the etymology of Satan. And of course, now if you go look up in like biblical concordances and all that, and it says that you know, it's basically originally meant adversary and things like that. But what this thing said was is that it started out, it was actually an intransitive verb that meant to persecute by prohibiting forward motion. So if you wanted to turn that into a noun, it would be adversarial. But
well, that's
why I never,
that's a cycle. That's the
Pardon?
Whole point. Well, that's the yeah. idea of the tree, is that it's this cycle. That's why you know, with the fall, you have the cycle of seven gets produced there. why in the center it's all circling around Shekinah, but it keeps you in a loop. So that in within a dimension, when we could be extending to other dimensions, that's my understanding of the nature of, at least, I mean, when you're talking about Satan, are you talking about the serpent in the garden? I mean, that's a leap that people make. But if you do, you know, if you consider what actually happens is you get the cycle gets in place, and then that's the six directions, and that's Da'at. Da'at is literally knowledge. It's the tree of knowledge, and it's part of the tree of life. It's like grafted onto the tree of life. You know, are you familiar with the idea of the 70 princes who rule the world from 70 quadrants? Have you ever heard that idea?
No. I mean, the closest I can come to that is like sort of Solomon's 72 names of God or something.
Oh, well, yeah, this is like
this is different. Isn't
well,
it?
This is it's actually relatively standard in traditional Kabbalah. That basically that the consciousness of the planet is influenced by these kind of like royal intelligences or whatever. And they're all at odds with each other. They're not in alignment, which is what distinguishes them from like the Tetragrammaton. Because the Tetragrammaton is all in balance, right? Whereas like the Klipot have no balance and they all have different ideas and they're all coming from different places. And then that's supposed to be reflected in the workings of the world as long as we're ruled over by these powers. We exude the same thing where we're looking to integrate, but everyone has a different idea of, that's why I can't buy the notion of like the Illuminati being all on the same page. It's like, there's definitely the Illuminati, but it seems like they're all in disagreement as to what they want to achieve in different ways. You know, it's a really interesting idea. There's actually a prophecy. It's the only prophecy I know of in the Zohar. With at the shift of the ages, so every 2,000 years the temple gets destroyed, it actually gives the equivalent date of 9/11, September 11th at the millennium. What is it? I've talked about this on the show quite a bit, but it trips me the fuck out. It's probably one of the craziest things I've ever come across in the Zohar in relationship to, you know, because you have Yakin and Boaz, right, the two pillars of the temple. And then those are reflected as the Twin Towers, which is literally a trade temple. And so Jesus turning over the money tables 2,000 years ago and being like, don't trade in the temple, gives the whole thing. It's like, we took it to the next level. You know, we made the temple for trade, you know. But the date that it gives for these three strongholds collapsing in what it calls Rome, right, was actually, I believe, the 25th of Elul, and then which is a few days off. Like September 15th or whatever. But then in the 18th century, a rabbi made an adjustment to that text, which actually makes it September 11th. And if you know, obviously, like the OTO and the Golden Dawn and Freemasonry, all these people always ascribe to the most recent adjustment. They don't ascribe to the old tradition. They add on, right? And so I was like, wow, that was something that I looked at with a rabbi, my teacher, that actually checked out. Because when people say dates and shit and do all this, you know, like for prophecy and stuff, it never does that, at least not in my experience. You know, fundamentalist Christians love to say that there's dates in the book of Revelations and this and that, but this is one that followed through. But the other reason I'm bringing it up is because it has this whole thing of that what is the purpose of the Messiah at that time, after the temple's collapse. It says that there's 70 stars that are the 70 princes, and they're keeping the world on a certain level in terms of dimensionality is the way it seems to translate, which is really far out. But then this one star comes and disperses them so that they're no longer have their hold on the planet. And that this event signifies that that's going to happen. Pretty trippy idea.
I'm going to look that up. Thank you for that, Dave.
It's very hard to look up. I will send you I have to look in my notes. I'll send you where that actually is in the Zohar, because the Zohar is huge. It's in book 3, and it's a specific section. It took me forever to find, because I found reference to it from a guy, Leo Zagami, and it was hard work to actually discover where it was, to bring it to my teacher and translate it together.
Be honest, I've never followed the traditional Kabbalah. My background, I probably first came across it, Gray's like Ladder of Lights and Talking Tree, and then Practical Guide to Kabbalistic Symbolism, Dion Fortune and right into Crowley and Grant and all that. Mm-hmm. And probably the closest I came to traditional Kabbalah was Carlos Suarez's work.
Mm-hmm.
His version of the Sefer Yetzirah and then his sort of Cipher of Genesis and stuff, where, which I found, are you familiar with his work, Carlos Suarez?
A little bit, but I resonate more with R.E.A. Kaplan. But yeah, I do know who you're referring to.
Yeah, yeah, no. Yeah, well, I just found it. I think it was actually reading Space, Time, and Beyond or something by the guy Tobin years ago, which was based on sort of some Fred Allen Wolf's. I think I could have even been Robert Anton Wilson. I'm not sure, but it was one of those sort of things around that time that I came across a reference to Suarez and looked him up. And yeah, so he sort of reinterprets like the first books of the Bible and says it. And that was where I started understanding that, you know, basically, you know, the Hebrew letters are the code. That's sure. The real thing. And the story on top is more of a mnemonic to, like, carry it forward, to preserve right. it. So it's not really the story. That's just the cover to hold the story underneath when you know the not the other Bible code that they put out that said that the name of the guys are supposedly the attackers in 9/11, not that silly Bible code, but the real
one. I don't know that one.
Oh, no, there was a book called The Bible Code, came out after 9/11, and supposedly these guys from NSA, like, worked out the...
Right. I mean, that's the thing, is that it's very rare that you'll come across something like that, and you'll do the cross-referencing, and it'll actually check out, especially when it comes mm-hmm. to dates. I mean, that's fucking far out. I mean, it actually has September 11th there. So, yeah, my mind was literally blown with that one.
That's fascinating, because somebody told me, my friend John Eisen, who's the editor of, he's an old New Yorker, but he's been in New Zealand for about 30 years. He's the editor of a magazine called Uncensored. And I also do the New Zealand Journal of Natural Health and stuff. But he was telling me, he goes, you know what's really up with 9/11? This was years ago. I go, no, he goes, that was Jesus's birthday. I go, well, if you accept he was born. He goes, he was. I'm okay. I'll accept it. You accept that. But it was he was insistent that he had some source that was claiming that 9/11 was Jesus's birthday. But this may have been a sort of a bastardization of what you're saying.
Well, just so you know, I'm not making this up. If anybody listening wanted to actually go to the trouble to find this, I don't know if there's any English translations of it as of yet. But yeah, Zohar 212b, 8a through 8b, and that's in the third book of the Zohar. That's where you'll find the destruction of the temple in Rome at the shift of the ages.
cool.
There's something I wanted to mention to you earlier. When you're talking about the Klippot and Da'at, recently I've been looking at some commentary on the Zohar that I guess this is a relatively common thing for rabbis to relate to. When you're looking at the tree of Da'at, they literally look at it like the seven species of food, but specifically the one that gets emphasized is wheat, that they literally have it that the shells, this is all allegorical, of course, but that the shells that surround the wheat, there's all these parts and the stalks, we're all eaten together. And then that's what constitutes the transgression, not actually eating of the food itself. So it's a very complex thing, but literally the klipot are four, just like the name is four, right? And they mirror it and they mimic it and they look to reproduce its perfection. But I thought this was really fascinating because literally Shekinah is a nut in the garden of the orchard of pomegranates, right? So there's this really weird idea where literally the shell around the nut is clefotic, and that's what's to be disregarded. But that what's the meat that literally translates as brain inside of the thing was holy. And so, you know, there's this notion that it's like, it's kind of a joke. It's like, eat of this thing that contains the holy, but what is enshrouding it will then change your perception. So it's like it's kind of a confusing matter, but it's like it's the thing is offered by God, knowing that, you know, we don't have a manual for what to do, and so it's like a troubleshooting thing, you know, but it's like long term troubleshooting, you know. It's kind of weird. I mean, I just never had that growing up, you know, when I went to a Christian school and they never mentioned that the tree of life, or the tree of knowledge itself, is actually contains the holy within it, and that what surrounds it that didn't get removed is clefotic. It's kind of interesting.
Well, it's interesting you bring up this idea of just like sort of sustenance or what have you, and I always try to find interconnections or the cross-pollination between these sort of self-development systems. So the Enneagram and Kabbalah, for example. So Gurdjieff talked about the Enneagram as he modeled it as a dinner table, and that you go through these intersections of the Enneagram as sort of these points of sustenance, and that you're taking on these sustenance. And Tom, you brought up Robert Anton Wilson, and he brought up these circuits, and you know, these circuits take on a certain amount of energy, and it's all distributed, and in the same sense as the Kabbalah, it's going along the path, and energy is distributed along this sort of circuit or something. And I can't help but see the parallels between them all. As much as we want to emphasize one over the other, or so on and so forth, depending on what we study or what we don't, I'm always fascinated by just the fractal nature of these things, that they all sort of express the same things. We, not the same things. I mean, they obviously have different aesthetics and different methodologies, but at the same time, they all come back to the same center, so to speak. And that resonated with me, just having touched a bit on Gurdjieff lately and having heard that, and especially like the pomegranate idea, where I just did an interview with Kira Young, and we were talking about pomegranates and this idea of sustenance in the darkness, and that even when, you know, the New Age focuses on nothing but the nice things, and but at the same time, the Jungian side or the Kabbalistic side or the Enneagram side or whatever focuses on, well, you can get sustenance from this sort of descent into the underworld, and there's always something to be had from going down there, and that it actually is it's a necessary part of the self-development process, and that these are proto-psychologies or something. And I think that's why people like Wilson and Rigardi and so on, and even maybe someone like Grant came around to bring modern psychology, or Jung brought modern psychology to Kabbalah or alchemy or these older systems of self-development. And Tom at Borderlands even got into free energy. And I know I got into, maybe it's hard to say how I exactly got into synchronicity, but free energy devices were definitely part of my, or perpetual motion machines, whatever label you want to attach to, were part of my journey into this subject matter. And free energy, I'm coming around more and more to this concept that it's sort of inverted alchemy, that we're looking for something outside that we're really supposed to be developing inside, that we're the same sort of alchemists that were saying, oh, I can literally turn lead into gold. And we laugh at them, or not laugh at them, but we say, well, you were sort of mistaken. This is actually a self-development process, not something to be turned into a technology or something to make kings rich. It's actually something to make yourself rich in your own mind. And so with free energy devices, it's the same sort of concept. Do you see that now, or do you still think there's something to that?
Well, no, I think that, well, I still remember, yeah, years ago, probably 85, 86, when Riley Crabb first got me out lecturing and stuff, and I was just giving a lecture on Tesla and radionics and showing these different technologies. And somebody said, what do you think would happen if we had free energy today? I said, we'd have crack gangs on the moon in a week.
Right? Yeah.
And I said, humankind's not ready for it yet. It's part of the archetypal development. So my interest was not in the free energy technology, but in what was in the minds of all these different people, Tesla, Farnsworth, Moray, Schellberger. How'd they all see it? They all had these different perspectives. And that's what I got more fascinated with, really, what I could say, what was the archetypal structure in their mind? How did they view the world? What was their interface? And as far as alchemy, I mean, so I do believe that there is true alchemy and transmutation is possible. Won't get too much into that.
I've got, well, I mean, cold fusion is always already an example of that.
Cold fusion is one example. A friend of mine showed me a number of experiments, I mean, just on paper, just various things, and you can find all the stuff at Rex Research as well, where they take different sort of gases and things and hit it with an electric thing, and they actually get little particles of gold and other elements. And if you add up all the atomic numbers, I got mates that's really into that. I've been trying to like pin him down and have an interview with him and learn a bit more. So hopefully we'll get to that. But as far as the alchemy, I mean, I was thinking of Powell's and Bergier's, you know, Eternal Man, Morning of the Magicians. Did you ever read that series, Dawn of Magic? Are you familiar with that at all? That would have been 70s, Morning of the Magicians. That was like...
I'm not. I don't know about Kevin or David.
Okay.
Sounds familiar. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, this is where I first came across Fulcanelli's work. I've actually still got my old paperbacks from the 70s on the shelf here. I was looking at them thinking I should reread them. It was quite interesting. I can't remember Powell's. One of them was a policeman. The other was like Israeli intelligence or something like that, which is quite fascinating sort of connection. I can't remember all the details. But what they do is they kind of point out, and they go through a lot of fascinating information on the cathedrals and all these different things and talk about alchemy. But when I read the book, and there was some, I was still a teenager at the time, probably heading into my early 20s, but something struck me as wrong. They were talking about the new alchemy as being nuclear physics. And the more I thought about this in later years, and I actually had some good long talks with Jerry Vassalatos, who wrote Lost Science and Secrets of Cold War Technology and the Vril compendiums and stuff. And he agreed that, you know, those books were some of the ones that turned him on to this sort of field. But then there was some underlying thing that it was almost like a con to get people into thinking that the real alchemy was getting into nuclear physics and that whole approach. Yeah. So, I mean,
maybe.
And that's maybe. Well, I mean, because there's also that whole thesis that Einstein's work was basically put out there to make sure that nobody could understand Tesla. That's why they put out the story. Well, there's only 7 people in the world that can understand like Einstein. Well, maybe it's not understandable. you know, maybe if you're at that stage that you're detached from reality. And of course, a lot of people didn't agree with Einstein. You know, him and Bohr had quite a bit of conflict over the, quantum sort of approach. You know, as Einstein said that he liked to think the world was there or the moon was there even when he wasn't looking at it. But nonetheless, it was if you ever get a chance, you'd probably find those books fascinating. You know, Morning of the Magicians was the first one. Then they came out with 4, Eternal Man, Impossible Possibilities, and Dawn of Magic. And they're all along the same sort of theme of pushing this concept. But as far as alchemy, I wanted to bring something in that I was going to bring up earlier in while we still were so at time is, and we're talking about CERN, and now we brought in alchemy. Because one of the things of alchemy as far as from spiritual alchemy was the like the squaring of the circle. You see that in alchemical diagrams. And of course, I'm sure you're probably familiar with like John Michell's work where he showed like if you take the earth and the moon, you know, you put the moon, a disk the size of the moon, attach it to a disk the size of the earth. Hi, you guys back?
Yeah, sorry, I hit the wrong button.
Oh, no, that happens. I was wondering, I was looking over at my modem, see, because, you know, I mean, like, I'm a third world country here. Oh, okay, well.
Let me get him back real quick, sorry.
Oh, good, okay.
I was really into that, what you were saying.
Oh, I just see those, Kevin sent a message here, he's got to hit the hay and be up in 5 hours.
Oh.
Okay, well, let's bring him on. And.
Yeah, I'll see if he answers.
Hey, Kevin, do you have to go to sleep, man?
Yeah, I'm going to have to knock out.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Hey, fascinating speaking with you, Kevin. I look forward to more. I probably talked too much and didn't get enough to listen to your ideas, but we'll get through that.
Oh, no. Yeah, it was such a pleasure, man. I really I didn't have a lot of time to see what you were all about before the show, and I really enjoyed like everything you had to say, so I hope we get a chance to chat again real soon.
Anytime. You got my Skype call. Even just want to have a chat, feel free.
That'd be cool. Yeah, definitely. I think we'd have more to talk about for sure.
Oh, totally. Hey, Cole, it was only about 15 minutes left, I think. I don't know how long these guys want to go, but you might want to catch this next little bit, even for another 5 minutes here.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, now I was talking about CERN and alchemy and the squaring of the circle with, you know, the Earth-Moon system, not only squaring the circle, but containing the mathematical structure of the Great Pyramid, which is very fascinating. So in my research on CERN, I came across something, and I had it checked out and through my friend Joe Dubs, that does a lot of, he does cosmic creations on Facebook. He does a lot of you know, fascinating sort of mathematical structure, platonic solid sort of stuff. And he actually did up a nice diagram for me. CERN, right, the outer ring, you know, the outer ring and the smaller, next smallest Atlas ring, they're the same relationship as Earth-Moon. This is the squared circle. They're working this stuff into CERN.
Ooh. Oh, let's end up by Scott. Scott Onstott would be stoked on hearing that.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, Scott's probably – oh, you guys know Scott. Yeah, I mean, I just know him through Facebook and stuff. But I've actually got some of Scott's stuff here, taken off his Secrets in Plain Sight, and I've been meaning to get in touch with him. And this is where he shows, because the LHC cuts through the center point of Paris and goes up to that obelisk in England, which is 33 degrees of, you know, radius of the Earth from the Dome of the Rock.
Right.
So CERN is tied in. And so I've actually, this is some of the research I've been doing. I haven't fully reached the point I want on. So I've basically been on top of that. That's where I've been thinking. I've been trying to figure this out. And I've been meaning to actually get in touch with Scott and ask him a bit more and show him where I was at. But him and Joe are actually in touch. And Joe said he was inspired by Scott's work. That's what actually got him into it. But he's done. So, I mean, if you on Facebook, if you check out Cosmic Creations, Joe does a lot of amazing sort of diagrams constantly.
And I've seen them.
Yeah. So, it's fascinating. So, I mean, yeah. So he actually did this diagram for me of the Earth, Moon, and Large Hadron Collider. And it's just, totally fascinating. He's posted it on Facebook. So there's much more to it than they're telling us. And I was also going to say, too, we were speaking earlier, I was talking about this guy, Louis Sancho, who did the movie Strange Matters and was part of that lawsuit against CERN, claiming it. So what he's saying is that they're actually trying to make strangelet liquid. And strangelets are combinations of quarks that only appeared right after the Big Bang, before the hadrons came together. And that's what he claims. This is what they're actually up to, is they're trying to manufacture hadrons. I mean, I was trying to manufacture strangelets, because the most explosive stuff on the planet, and that, you know, this is the ultimate aim of, because this is all part and parcel from the days of Galileo on up, part of the military weapons development program, and this is the ultimate weapon, is the strangelets, you know, far more powerful than any, you know, nuclear sort of explosive up to date. So
they don't even know, though. Right? I mean,
I don't believe in that kind of physics. I'm just fascinated that these guys think it.
No, I know. Well, this is that's the thing. That's the thing. So every time, man, I'm like, it doesn't matter to me as much whether or not a lot of, like, I look at Oppenheimer and some of the shit that he said, and I'm just like, this is their belief system. I'm more interested in how these people relate or rationalize what it is that they're up to and all the different layers to that. And like that's something that I don't even, because I mean, they have to be thinking on some level that if you create a movement in this direction, it'll create a binary movement or something in another. Like, it seems like there's this kind of like, well, if we go this far, then something else, you know. I don't know what they're, how they process that. It's so weird.
My mom knew Oppenheimer. She actually took classes from him and stuff.
She
never talked about it. I can never get much info, so I don't know. She worked at the University of Chicago a bit, so I think she knew Fermi as well. Huh. She had her master's in physics and was basically a physics teacher, and married my old man, who was a college professor in Chicago. So that's, I'm sort of from that background. But
didn't Fermi die real young, and then Oppenheimer sold out Bohm to the McCarthy hearings? So Oppenheimer is kind of a dick, actually, as far as I'm concerned.
It could have been. Yeah. I remember my mom saying that, and I thought later, after she passed away, I go, I never really pursued. I asked her a few times, and she sort of brushed it off. And I regretted never really having questioned her more about those days. Because she used to have, when I was young, I remember there's a lot of physics books. I remember looking through that stuff. That would have been from like the 40s, and I didn't know that much about it. And I was probably like 8, 9 last time I saw that stuff. So it didn't really stick with me at the time. But I'm sure it's influenced where I've come all these years later.
And it's not to criticize Oppenheimer completely, because he has great quotes and contribute a lot to what we consider to be materialist science, but he was part of the 40s, 50s, 60s era that was all about producing external results and this sort of like inverse alchemy, producing the atomic bomb and so on. And right. He sold out David Bohm, who's what may be my favorite scientist of all time. And that was a very cowardly thing to do. And so I lost a lot of respect for him along the way in hearing that story. And so,
yeah, well, he had the patent on the nuclear bomb or I can't remember if it was the atomic or the nuclear, but he basically had patents on that stuff. He became extremely wealthy from that.
Oh yeah. I had no idea about that, but just generally, you know, it's these characters are put on pedestals in our culture, and it's like, what's the true story behind them? And well, he was just a man, and he had weaknesses, and he was actually sort of pathetic in certain ways, and let's be honest about how he treated other people. And so Oppenheimer's a mixed bag.
Yeah, well, humans, I mean, yeah, they're kind of disappointing in a general sense. They give people a bad name. So what can you do? Right. I mean, you know, we've all done well. The thing is, as I say, you know, it doesn't matter what you did in the past. It's what you do in the future. You know, it's like, it's all about learning. And that's why I like sort of also the Bardo Thodol approach, you know, Book of the Dead and the different sort of things. And as I was told years ago, living out on a Native American camp in Nevada, back in the 80s, that early 80s, that, yeah, that was sort of, you know, as you're walking to the spirit world, you know, you meet everybody in life. And if you did right by them, you get by. If you did wrong by them and learned and made amends through your actions, even if you didn't exactly get a chance to go back to that person because you never saw them again, then you would basically, you would get by. But if you did wrong by somebody and you didn't, you get sent back. You couldn't make it, you know, to the old happy hunting ground, so to speak. And, of course, that's very much the whole, you know, peaceful and wrathful deities, with the peaceful deities being our connections through the heart, wrathful deities through the mind and our interactions. And of course, I mean, because I've been in basically 10 years of being hassled by the I'm a major crown victim, but they attempt to make me a victim. I'm not really easily victimized, so I just sort of smile through it. But I've been going through court for years over all these like bogus, you know, tax charges and stuff, because I've been working with like the native Maoris and stuff. And I've come to this point where I'm actually total peace with it. I just watch it happening, and it's amazing how many of my friends, very progressive, intelligent people here, are all like in all this strife. You know, they've got like teams of people out, like we call them the existential demons. But I find that I look at like judges and prosecutors and stuff. They are basically the wrathful deities that I'll be dealing with in the Bardo. So this is Bardo training. Right, so I just stand there and tell the truth and smile, and you know, just whatever happens, you know, I can't determine the outcome. I can only act properly and do the best I can. I mean, I do believe we have a certain amount of control. You know, if you go through, you know, what Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill stuff, there's actually quite a profound metaphysics in there, and contacting the subconscious, which does seem to control, you know, the forward progression of events in our lives. Not from the simple secret sort of way, but in the much deeper sort of sense over time, where you build these things up, and especially when you work with a mastermind group. So, yeah, and that's why I wonder where in the world I've had to deal with all these complications and stuff. I thought, well, no, it's actually, I'm blessed with the opportunity to actually, you know, face up with some of like the direct archonic manifestations. As I say, the heart of the beast that has no heart. and they're rather
in the heart of the city.
Now they're rather puzzled, you know, that, you know, I'm just like smiling through the whole thing and like all real friendly and stuff, and it's like yep, because it's fascinating, because I'm working with the reawakening of the native authority here, which is guaranteed in international law and local treaty and stuff. And of course, you know, the British Crown, they swindled everybody they made a deal with, they screwed, and we all know that.
Yeah.
But the Maoris got the best deal. It's fascinating, you know, that their native sovereignty has been recognized internationally in 1835. And then it was enshrined in a treaty in 1840. They called Te Tiriti o Waitangi, the Treaty of Waitangi, which English versions were total mistranslations. It said how they signed their sovereignty over and all that, but the Maori versions didn't. And the Crowns actually came out last year and admitted that the Maoris never signed their sovereignty over. They're going, oh, but too bad. We got it now anyway. And they're going, no, sorry, wait a minute. No. So it's quite fascinating being in the middle of all that, is in the middle of all this other sort of process. And I had this vision in my meditations a couple of weeks ago, and it was sort of like I was looking at sort of the super sensible sciences. I felt myself in the middle. I was quite tired and exhausted of all the things going on. I thought, just trying to find a point of peace and rest. And it was like these four things coming out. You know, one axis was basically, one side of the axis was the super sensible sciences, the etheric sciences, cosmological botany. And on the other side was this whole particle physics model and the standard model, CERN, all of that research. Then the other axis was the sort of the native sovereignty, and underlying that, all these sort of expressions of self-determination, which are coming out in more or less perfect and imperfect forms around the world, you know, from, you know, the sovereign citizens to the freemen. And it's just this general soul struggle of people trying to do it. But, you know, say that's what makes New Zealand a unique place, because it was actually guaranteed here by treaty. And to actually be there, I'm one of the key people that's stuck in between the Crown and the Northern tribes who have adopted me in. It's actually a fascinating place to be. People go, oh, man, sorry to hear you're in the middle of all that. I go, no, man, what a blessing. I go, man, how many people get this experience? This is fascinating. Whatever happens, I don't know. But it's fun to see and try. And that's why I believe that, you know, if you look at, like, the standard scientific thing, then, you know, there was just this big bang and everything happened. And there might have been all these, like, multiple universes. But we just happen to be in one where just by chance everything fell together just right. And by this other chance, you know, some organic compounds fell together when lightning hit a pool of jizz, and then, you know, the slime crawled out. You know, and now we've made it up to this great place, and, you know.
Dude.
I'm so glad you talked to jizz.
I mean, isn't that.
No, there's a whole. Okay, you guys. I got these friends that do this whole thing where instead of saying om, they actually say jizz. We're like, jizz is the source. We'll literally sit there and go, jizz, like, in all seriousness. They're super serious about it. It's not a joke for them. It's really interesting.
Wow. That's why I say that's my short history of the universe. First there was nothing, then it exploded, then lightning hit a pool of jizz and made fish, and then they crawled out, made dinosaurs, and then comet hit, then mammals arose. Now we got to pay taxes.
Well, now we got to wait for the second coming.
All of it.
Exactly. We need to know. Yeah, second coming takes on new meaning in that sort of theme.
Jeez.
In a metamorphic sense. Well, that's what I believe. I don't believe in straight line evolution. I mean, obviously, there is a progression. But if you go back to, like, the Cambrian explosion, there was more phyla that existed at that time. More types of life existed at the very beginning than have existed in all the time ever since put together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can they say that was evolution? You know, there's basically a metamorphosis of manifestation.
Yeah.
And that's why I like Steiner sort of said the evolution of the earth was like Adam Kadmon being, you know, and I sort of tied that in a bit with, like, Julian Jane's concept. Because Steiner talked about, you know, some point where, you know, the Adam Kadmon being had to die in order for that, you know, individuated consciousness could arise on its path towards, you know, spiritual liberation. Mm-hmm. And that would tie in with Julian Jane's sort of origin of the bicameral mind and those things. And it also sort of ties in with those theories of the canopy theory of plant, you know, old Isaac Newton Vale's nebular theory of planetary development with the canopy of water, and then when it collapsed, which a lot of the biblical creationists are into as far as, like, you know, having caused the flood.
Well, there's the breaking of the vessels in the Tsimsum, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about? So, yeah, like, you can't contain it. Bohm talked a lot about that concept with Krishnamurti, where it's like the consciousness can't be contained, and so it bursts out, you know, but then in Kabbalah, there's this notion that I think it's just from the Ari. I don't know how far back the Tsimsum idea actually goes. Just showing my ignorance here, but that the world is actually formed from the shells of the vessels, as far as our perceptions are concerned. And so that's a very interesting concept there. If you watch the film Life of Pi, you'll notice that Simsum is written on the side of the ship. That has no other meaning in any other language that I know of. I mean, and literally it's referring to the breaking of the vessels. It's very symbolic.
And that correlates with the water, you know, the amniotic fluid and the water breaking and so on and so forth, the Great Flood.
Right. Well, I mean, it's in the book, just so you know. I mean, I think I said film, just to be clear. I mean, that's it's referred to as. So.
Kind of fascinating. Fun. Yeah. No, I have to watch. Long ago, I watched those videos of Bohm and Krishnamurti, the discussions. I'll have to review those again. That'll be
quite fascinating.
Krishnamurti is. It's just confusing. It's not that it's not getting at something. It's just that it's hard to follow him sometimes because he really is getting at these sort of fundamental questions. And the deeper we get, the more confusing it does get. So when he's really questioning like the fundamentals of the fundamentals. It almost is like, well, how can I even begin to answer that question? And you notice that when he poses a question to Bohm, it's like it's a question about human reasoning or how we've gotten into our predicament.
Well, he'll take you to the point where you have nowhere left to go. And that's the whole point, because then you're receptive, finally. Like, that's the thing. You'll have on these experts, and they'll be interviewing them, and they'll go, oh, I'll tell you, you know, and then he literally gets them to the point where their brains freeze. Which is exactly what they need, you know. It was exactly what we need, you know.
Yeah, and maybe I guess I'm coming around more. Maybe that was a motive, and not so much as like a byproduct of his approach. It was actually like what he was trying to do was.
Oh, he knew exactly what he was.
Yeah,
trying to do.
and you have to give the dude credit. I mean, like anyone that's brought up as a messiah and then able to reject this sort of messiah mantle has got to be quite a persona. Even if he's not like the one or something, it's just like able to resist that temptation and just adorn that mantle and be like, yeah, I'm the one. Listen to what I have to say. Let me give you the big T truth. And so even if I don't resonate with everything he says, it's like I have endless respect for just that ability to be able to do that.
Yeah, well, I don't think he wanted to be the Messiah. I mean, that was sort of Leadbeater's sort of a pick after sort of the problems with Janara Jadasa. Yeah, I mean, they say, you know, if you mention Leadbeater's name around Krishnamurti, he'd like throw up and stuff. He couldn't stand him. I mean, because I don't know, are you familiar with a book called The Elder Brother by Greg Tillett? The story of Leadbeater? I mean, basically, he was like an international pedophile.
He had some sketchy patterns of behavior. And so the question is, well, you know, did he, not to get too dark, but did he bring in Krishnamurti just to like molest him? I don't know.
No, he was using, it was black magic. He was basically, because if you actually read like the Science of the Sacraments, which I had read when I was younger, but then after reading Tillett's book, you know, he's talking about how every night, you know, that in his meditations, he would roll the sacred books into a roll and rub his hands up and down until the answer would burst forth. Now I get it. I didn't get it when I first read it, but when Tillett pointed out what was going on, so basically we could say it was a form of sexual magic of a perverse sort. The interesting thing is Bertio gave me that book to read, and I actually believe Bertio was the incarnation of Leadbeater. He was quite, because he was a same kind of background, came out of Anglican thing, got into the Theosophical Society and then the Liberal Catholic Church and became a bishop, and he was like one of the leading bishops in there and stuff, and there's stuff really paralleled, and I just sort of had that feeling somewhere. I go, God, I think this guy's actually Leadbeater.
Real quick, before you go on with that story, let me interrupt, just ask a question. As far as reincarnation goes, are in a situation like that, can we really say that, oh, this person has totally incarnated this person one-to-one? There's a one-to-one correlation that this entire soul or this entire consciousness has transmigrated or transmutated into this person. I tend to take the holographic approach where, depending on how much a person or a personality has imprinted the general consciousness of their sort of era, so they've been a part of the zeitgeist, they sort of, depending on the person and who knows how we're cosmically imprinted, we take on parts of people. So people will say, oh, I'm the reincarnation of Crowley, I'm the reincarnation of Tesla, one-to-one, like he's all in me and I'm all him, but all I see are little bits and pieces. So I don't know if I necessarily buy the the complete transmigration hypothesis? I mean, where do you come down on that?
I think it's possible. I've tried to keep open mind. I do actually think, because, I mean, if you look at sort of like the Tibetan tulkus and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. They've mapped out over the centuries and potentially longer, because it probably came out of the old Bon religions, of mapping the bardos so that they could come mm-hmm. back through. But I believe that really is dependent on the interrelationship of the chakra system, the elemental thing. So they can actually go back into, if you're not fully integrated and initiated at the highest levels or enlightened or whatever, then your sections can kind of, like, maybe the bottom three are still contain, you know, it might even be this being bottom two, you know, the different elements are connected. And then when you're reborn, those come together. They might just pull in like the higher chakras again from the elemental sea. And then those, you know, the bottom four then form the higher ones, because that was the thesis, is that when the four lower ones, when you went through the initiations of the four elements or had lived through sort of precess, you know, different lifetimes as the sun precessed through the equinox and had your experiential background to connect all of them, that's when the heart crown system actually started functioning at its higher level. So I do believe it's possible, but then again, I do understand what you're saying about, you know, just perhaps the fractality, you know, that you're putting into it and coming back out. And that would sort of fit with the elemental sea sort of thing. Because Steiner spoke about, you know, one of the tasks of our civilization was to free the elementals from the earth through mining and stuff and bring them into like technological right. processes. So that all this, and this is what part of the thesis I've thought up over the years, is with all this mining and pulling everything up, pulling the oil out of the ground and all that, all these elementals are being released. Because people are saying, well, if there's incarnation, how come there's more people now than there ever were before? Well, maybe they're not conscious souls yet. Maybe, you know, because supposedly the soul's not a conscious soul until the four lower chakras are fully
that's
linked.
Right. Yeah, even in Kabbalah, I mean, that's very basic. The soul is something that you build, and you'll see that all over the place. I mean, Plato would reference that notion too. I mean, not just reference it. That was his belief, was that you build up a soul. There's different levels to the souls. I mean, and you could have multiple souls. Like, there's all these other. We have a very, like, it's like this Christian kind of very limited bent on that gets presented as if this was like the standard view or something. It's like, it's so weird.
Right, right. Your soul's like your body. It pops out, pops in, right?
Yeah, like you have a soul. It's like you don't have a soul, man. If anything, your soul has you. Like, where are you looking from? You know, what's your vantage point? It's like...
all right. Well, it's interesting because we've actually discussed this over the years, because, I mean, a lot of people in the so-called Freeman movement and all that sort of stuff is what we finally came down to, because nobody wants to be a person, right? Because person is a corporate entity and an artificial entity, you know, in legalese.
Let me sign this ticket.
Yeah, I'll sign as representative of that person, right? But I'm the beneficiary. You're the trustee, aren't you, officer? You're a public trustee. Right? they go like that. But see, that's what people say, you know, that's what I'd say, you know, I'm not human. And that also, too, because in legal dictionaries, a human is a monster. People go, I'm not human. I'm a living soul, because humans are monsters. I said, but you're misinterpreting that. The human without a soul is a monster. But I said, I'm a living soul. I own this body that I live in. This is my body, right? I'm domiciled in it for now. The body's my residence. I'm domiciled in it. But this gets into, like, a lot of people will get into, like, UN sort of treaties and stuff on the 48 Declaration on Human Rights and stuff, which are actually fascinating documents. People go, oh, no, UN, blah, 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 human rights. It's all human. They're monsters. I'm going, but wait, stop and think. What can you legislate against internationally? You can't legislate against spiritual beliefs or perspectives or anything like that. The only thing that you can protect by legal convention is the rights of people's physical beings. So naturally, the human rights are where that has to sit. But yeah, as far as, like, you know, I say, that's what I always say. Yeah, I'm a living soul. I have a human body. I'm not going to stay in it forever. I'd like to think I'm integrated enough to carry on, but I don't know. I might just be like fooling myself. You never really know. we find out. There will be a day we find out. Hopefully that'll be a few decades in the future for me. I'm in no hurry here.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's, I'm not sure the degree in terms of like the outward direction of the senses if through anything that's observable through the senses, if you could ever get there. I mean, that seems to be the one of the core teachings in multiple systems, especially like, I mean, that was one of Patanjali's number one points, you know, or perhaps his number one point, you know, is that you can't see the thing through its outpouring. Like if you're directed in terms of emanation, there's no amount of using the materials that are at hand to reveal what it's stemming from. Who was it? Rainer Rilke, right? He had that on his tombstone, the rose, oh, pure contradiction, delight of being no one's sleep under so many lids. In other words, like if you're to look at the petals as eyelids, like they can't look back to see the stem. They're all faced away.
Right, right. But and that is, I mean, and that's sort of, we can see how that sort of underlying, you know, the philosophy of Immanuel Kant as sure. well as, which is like totally infiltrated into quantum sort of stuff. And people say, well, this is how basically Eastern mysticism is interpreted as well. And this is what I found fascinating. Like I was talking earlier about, you know, when I kind of came across Goethe's work and Metamorphoses of Plants and the Optics, that totally changed my perspective on all my, I basically discarded all the Kabbalistic stuff in a general sense as being a path to follow and only kept with me the archetypal structures, which I then tried to bring into this new understanding. And the difference was, is that like, I think we talked about this, Dave, before you got on. Can't remember because I've been having so many conversations lately. But as Goethe said, the senses don't deceive. The judgment deceives. We need to train our senses so that we're not deceived by them and we're not totally reacting to them. But and that's what Goethe was working towards, what he called the exact sensorial fantasy, so that we could actually spiritually participate in the knowledge of the formative processes of life and therefore get past this impasse of Kant in the process.
Right. Well, this is the, to make a clear reflection, like this is the idea of sattva guna, right? So you have rajas, tamas, and sattva, the three-stranded rope. And so that's why you emphasize the sattva, not because you're actually, you know, becoming more spiritual, really. It's just that you're allowing it to shine in more. You can see it, its expression through the thing more. It's a very strange idea because they'd say, you know, in Samkhya, in the Kartika, it's like you can't ever see Purush. You can only see Prakriti. You can see Mula Prakriti, which is where Prakriti unifies, right? So where matter becomes one. You can see how everything's unified, and that's an ecstatic experience, right? But no, like that in and of itself isn't what constitutes moksha. That's just what allows for the different levels of samadhi to take hold. But like even then, it's like you're just allowing something that's still only inferred to become so inferred that it's like express, it seems to express itself. It's a very strange idea. It's hard to communicate that one.
No, I think I get what you're talking about. I don't remember all those terms. I've come across them. I have read through a lot of that Eastern work in the past, but God, it's hard to remember everything.
Yeah, Viveka Kiyakti. It's the discriminative intellect. So you're recognizing what can be inferred and what can be known. And so things are kept in perspective in that way. You're like,
right?
How much can you infer? It's like when it's like if you're working on a conspiracy theory, right? And like the information starts to add up and add up and add up. The less you take an ultimate position, the less you take a conclusion. The more when you know it'll reach to a breaking point where you're like everything points to this. It's like Occam's razor to the extreme. So like that's. In essence, from what I gather, is like the what constitutes samadhi is just deeper and deeper and deeper inference, where inference becomes so strong that it might as well be known, you know, even though it still can't be known in terms of perception.
Well, I think the inference is, I think that's perhaps, I've been trying to think out how I could actually explain the way I understand Goethe's work. I haven't really been able to form it into words, you know, how the because I've tried to discuss this with a friend of mine who's actually a brilliant, you know, student of, he's got master's in philosophy and one in like evolutionary biology. And yeah, God, he's like smart, man. So I gotta have a discussion with smart people. I really gotta like be on my toes. But yeah, but I've been trying to like think, how do I actually explain how it is? I'm still actually struggling to explain the way I see it. But I think this, well, you're saying the inference, right? That might be a way, because if I look at like cosmological botany, I look at the complex motions of the planets as they appear from Earth, the way the Mercury moves around the sun, the way the Venus, it moves around the sun as the sun moves around the Earth. So we're getting these complex patterns. Mm-hmm. Then you look at plants, and like the stem is always the sun. And then the leaves are basically Mercury and Venus and their various forms. And then the further branchings out of the plant are then going to be like Mars and Jupiter, their influences. And then when you get to trees, you're looking at basically Jupiter and Saturn, right? Because they pull things up a bit more. And I'm looking at this, and like what Goethe was talking about was this wasn't just an idea. Well, he didn't deal with it in the planetary sense. This is more sort of evolved thing that's come out of the anthroposophical point of view, the cosmological botany. But Goethe could see this metamorphoses of plants and his archetypal plant. And like when he was discussing it with Schiller, his first sort of meeting with Schiller, and Schiller sort of, he agreed with a lot of his ideas on morphology, but he got upset with the fact that, Goethe had this idea. He says, but we can only think that idea up. We can never like truly experience an idea. And Goethe's going, actually, I am. I'm
right. It depends on what you mean it's a matter of qualification. And what does it mean to experience? I mean, what does it mean for something to, like, if something's standing out in space, then we say it exists. If it's nominal, we don't refer to it as existing. And so that becomes, I mean, what you're saying about the sun, I find really interesting in terms of Nassim Haramein's work, where he would say that, for lack of a better word, I guess, the sun is a black hole. It's just, we're looking at the emanating energy and we can't see the contractive side. So in the same, like, just to oversimplify something that couldn't get any, any simpler, it's like for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? And I mean, you appreciate this. You might school me. I don't even know. It's just, this is so basic. I'm no physicist, obviously. But like, when I think of like, oh, well, you tell me the universe is expanding, how could you assume that like somewhere down the line it's going to contract? Isn't it contracting now? Isn't that what's allowing for the expansion? And like, this seems so basic, and yet it's something that I don't hear emphasized enough. Or like, that there, if there's an order to the expansion, wouldn't there be an order to the contraction? Like, and like, where are we looking from? Like, we can't look from the other side of the sun. Like, we're all looking up at the sun, seeing emanating energy. How can we go to the other side of the dimension? We can't, in terms of our perception.
Especially if you look at the sun as being like Tifereth on the tree. I don't believe the Earth is. I don't believe the universe is expanding.
Right.
That's all based on redshifts, which are seriously in question when you look at plasma cosmology, and especially when you get into like Halton Arp's work with the discordant redshifts and attached galaxies and stuff.
And one of the best, and not to interrupt you, Tom, but one of the best things to look at investigating that question is called the Pioneer Anomaly. And one of my favorite occult physicists, if you want to call him that, or I just call him a physicist and a systems theorist, Paul LaViolette. He has done some of the best work, I think, since Halton Arp in terms of analyzing cosmology.
Absolutely.
And redshifts versus redshifts.
And I like Paul's work. It's brilliant, his whole galactic superwave. Mm-hmm. It's, I've absorbed all that into my thesis. That's why I like listening to all these different people. I try to come to general conclusions so I can express where I'm at the time, but yeah, I'm always in flux and always open for new information. But I have definitely gone off the whole black hole expanding universe, because when you look at Halton Arp's work and the electric universe theories, basically the black hole is the mathematical endpoint of Newton's seeing the apple fall out of the tree. But he never explained the forces that raised the tree up, these higher, finer forces, which aren't apparent to the discursive consciousness. You need to create new organs of cognition through what they call the Goethean method, by processing the entire life cycle of the plant and viewing it as a whole in that sense. And that's why Steiner said that in a sense, then you can look at it's an ethereal being, the ether being the whole time thing. So we could look at the plant at any one point. Is this the plant? Is it the plant when it's sprouting? Is it the plant when it's just got leaves? Is it the plant when it's flowering? Is it fruiting? He said, all of those. The only true plant is that entire thing through time. And to be able to put that whole process in your mind is the thing. And I was saying, whereas you come from the Newtonian side, well, the thing dropped, let's, you know, like work out the inertialistic properties, and you know, that's how everything works in the universe. So I don't really believe there's black holes in that sense.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.